Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Would you like to have some tea first?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. That he was disillusioned with, you know, he hated Nazism, what you say in the biography.
Yes.
He hated Nazism, but he loved Germany.
Germany.
Yeah.
He loved Germany.
Yeah.
And he kept that. And he never, in spite of all the war experiences, he remained very patriotic from that point of view. And yeah. I think, as I explained it, he went back to Germany as soon as he could.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was very interesting. It was very interesting to me to observe how these wars didn't necessarily lead to disillusionment.
But that is one of the you quote.
Yeah.
I've seen the Brierleaf report, which is one of the most interesting.
Yeah.
It's in the Oxford University Press archives.
Yes. Yes.
You quoted extensively, and in that Brierleaf says,
If
he weren't a Jew, he would have been a German nationalist.
Well, he was a German nationalist.
Yeah.
But he was a German nationalist, I think. And of course, one of the things if you can go back in scholarship, he was very pupil he knew Lenin very well, and he said that the most disgraceful thing to Lenin was, who Lenin had been in the Franco-Prussian War.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been at Versailles, you know, he had been in the founding of the German Empire, and then, and yet because he was a Jew, he was treated by the Nazis, I suppose, like everybody else, he wasn't allowed to continue in the university post. No.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was the most disgraceful way of treating a patriotic young.
Pringsheim also was he called himself that, Nicht Arier Frontkämpfer.
That's an interesting way of describing yourself.
But it must have been
Frontkämpfer. It was very important to him.
Yeah.
And I understand it exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, if I can just speak about my own background, of course, I was at a school in South Africa, in Cape Town, Bishop School, where there were many Afrikaners from the Boer Republics. And we always respected and admired the fact that when the Boer War broke out in 1899, they returned to the Free State and the South African Republic to fight for their country.
Yeah.
It was a natural thing to do.
Yeah.
Everybody should fight for their country, of course, in a war. Now this sounds so completely out of date, doesn't it? But in those days, it wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was part of your commitment. Yeah.
But you fought in the Second World War.
Yes,
I fought at El Alamein.
Yes, I was at El Alamein.
How did you, let me start with how did you get to be, you call yourself a pupil, the only English-speaking Roman law pupil of Pringsheim, how did you get to know Pringsheim?
Pringsheim, of course, had come and settled in Oxford in 1939. He didn't have an official position. He wasn't really properly appreciated, I think, by the local faculty and so forth. But he did have as Roman law was compulsory subject to teach in the law faculty here, he did have some teaching. And among other colleges, he did some teaching for Worcester College, and I wasn't at Worcester College, but I was tutored by the Worcester tutor at the time, and he had this contact with Pringsheim, and so I was sent to Pringsheim for tutorials. So this was how I came to know Pringsheim. Yeah. And we got on well together and so forth. It ended up with my advising him really about the language, I suppose, of his book on Wheatlaw Sale, mm-hmm. which came out and was published. It was published, it was published in the German Democratic Republic, the DDR. I think at the beginning of the DDR, something wanted to seem intellectual and respectable.
Yes.
In the, you know, in the... that's right. So
you were sent to the tutor at Worcester College sent you to to Pringsheim, obviously, but he was, as I understand your biography correct, he was a bit of an outsider in Oxford at the time.
Yes, he was an outsider.
Yeah, he didn't hold official position.
No.
But neither, my benchmark on that remained Schultz, who also did not hold official position.
No,
Schultz was much more in the...
Schultz was more... I didn't really know Schultz, but and I wasn't. I mean, it wasn't a sort of group that met and discussed in Oxford. I don't think it was. No.
But
Schultz was connected more with Brasenose College, Pringsheim. Well, in this particular case, with Worcester College and their new college, which is where I was.
Yeah.
So, because you have to think about this as being a collegiate university. And therefore, the connection with the college doesn't mean you're not connected with the university exactly. It's that the university worked so largely through the college system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But you were tutored by Pringsheim in what is also basically a rather esoteric subject still, I would say, at Oxford. Roman law. In common law.
Esoteric subject. Well, that's the matter is that it's so compulsory in your education in Oxford. It's been an abandoned law, isn't it? It had a position on which it's not got as prominent as it used to have, but it's not the dominant eye.
It's presented, which I always find utterly charming, and civil law. It is the partial toto for civil law, and
it's the chair of civil law. But you see. If I go back to it, it was funded by Henry VIII, and his idea, undoubtedly, for supporting it, was that he was equal with the canonists, so he didn't want canon law.
Mm-hmm.
But civil law was very much more sympathetic to Henry VIII's idea. Which was that he was a sort of emperor and he could decide. Of course, it is largely about the nullity of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. I mean, it's a long, drawn-out story, but he was extremely keen on this. It was in the forefront of his mind.
Yeah.
So civil law was therefore important.
Yeah.
And and have descended, I mean, this particular chair has descended through him and through.
Yeah. Regis professorship. Professorship.
And James the First, in particular, in the 17th century, settled some money on the process. That's why this Civil War tradition remained important.
I've been drinking
and quick enough. I'm still at a continental tempo.
You don't need tea.
Take it away. But the thing is, you are, it's a compulsory subject for a little. So you're But why did you, how did that evolve into your interest for Roman rule? How did that make you go into...
I'm a South African, you see. And so I was brought up in South Africa, and I was at school with a man who... who was a lawyer and had been a Rhodes Scholar. We were interested in law and cricket, actually. He had been to Oxford. I mean, this story was nothing to do with you really, but Cecil Rhodes, before he died, he was thinking of this scholarship idea, and he asked school if they had some suitable person to send to Oxford to test out his idea, and they went into it, and there were two people, and so Rhodes said, "We'll send both," and one of them. I knew very well, he was connected to the school and so forth, but he'd been over here and had studied Roman law over here, and as we have a mixed system in South Africa, partly Roman and partly civil, but he always said that the best legal system was the Roman. I remember this from school days. So of course I had an interest in it from early on.
Yeah, and it has these weird similarities to common law as well, which is one of the things Pringsheim, the inner relationship between English law and Roman law.
He was very interested. And he's quite right, because, I mean, not 100% right, but he was right in that a very great deal of Roman law is built up of discussions of particular cases and opinions given in particular cases.
Mm-hmm.
So just as the English law is formed by discussion between judges and counsel, that's how English law is made. Roman law is made, well, very largely by opinions given by lawyers, but the authority of the emperor in a way, but not directly. And a lot of my work on Roman law has been exactly about that, to show that the legal profession was, in a certain sense, independent, even under the empire. It had its own culture, its own way of thinking. That's been my theme.
I've read it several times, but the biography of Hayes, I've just went to Berlin Bochum and looked at that again. And
but I mean, still more of my biographies of Archer.
Yeah.
Upianus.
Yeah.
Being along those lines.
Yeah, as well as in-person lawyers.
That's been my thing in running lawyers.
But that's very interesting that you mentioned, because it is one of the things that both Bringsheim stresses that as well, sort of this importance of this independent class of jurists to make law as primary lawmakers.
Yes.
And is that something you were inspired by, for instance, when you the Gaius came out when Bringsheim was still alive? So yes. In 1962, I think Bringsheim died in 1967.
Yes, he said. I don't think he discussed it in great detail, but he was delighted with it, of course, that I had produced it.
He was happy. He was very happy with it. And Did he review it?
No, he didn't review it.
That alone.
But nevertheless, of course, he was pleased with his two poems. So to that extent, and because of the fact that he was teaching in Freiburg,
mm-hmm.
When I was working on with horizontal causation, it was to Freiburg that I went, and there that I worked on causation, of course, in the modern law, but still. But it was because of the Freiburg connection that was my law. And still is, as a matter of fact, because my modern connection in Roman law is with Detlef Lips, who is in Freiburg. So it's an ongoing connection, shall we say.
Detlef
Lips is now retired and they are.
One of my colleagues has been invited by him in Freiburg to speak about Wiacker. Lips wrote, which I actually have with me, Lips wrote one of the main biography of Wiacker. Such a kind man.
That is a connection with Wiacker. I don't have a direct connection. Well, I met Wiacker, of course, but he was in Göttingen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I have an important connection.
Which is Wiacker was of course also a pupil of Bringsheim. But it must have been, that's one of my main question marks.
Yeah.
And so you start the pupillage at Bringsheim.
Yeah.
In that must have been after 1945.
Yeah, it's 46, 7.
Yeah.
7, 8, 7, 8.
Yeah. And one of the weirdest things about Bringsheim, compared to, for example, Schuch, is that he almost immediately, as soon as the war is done, he's almost immediately back in Freiburg.
Yes. That's right. Because he was patriotic. And he thought, I don't know how far I've done this in this thing, but he was patriotic and he wished to reconstruct German university life along new lines. So he went back there in 1946, although it was under French military occupation. So that he was asked about democracy, in other words, and he said, "Don't talk about democracy. We're under French military occupation, I'm pretty sure." But there are two points he told the pupils that you must remember. First of all, we have been, for 7 years, we've been subject to rhetoric. Now, you're university students. Don't just repeat what you're told. Always ask, what is the evidence for that? And that was very, very important to him, and very important for the German reconstruction. Rightly, I think.
Yeah.
So that was point one. Point two was derived more from Oxford experience. Let associated in hostels, run their own affairs and discuss things among themselves and form their own views by talking to other pupils. Mm-hmm. And that was the sort of Oxford derived idea.
Yeah, yeah. He almost, there's this
new college, college system.
Yeah.
Introduce sort of the college system into German universities. So those are the two important things I thought, and he's basically right about this, I think.
Yeah. And you have seen that as well, that there's a report of him.
Yeah.
Which he goes to Freiburg in, I believe, in 1946 already.
Yes,
1945, perhaps.
46, yes.
Yeah. And so he writes this report, which is one of the most beautifully written things I've ever seen about life at the Freiburg University straight after this. You can almost, I'd call it a catastrophe, but I think perhaps apocalypse might be a better word, because just everything is destroyed.
Yeah.
And the students are basically the soldiers coming back from
war.
Yeah, being, well, mentally destroyed.
Yes,
and they've been broken.
Yeah.
And he writes this gorgeous report about exactly this, but how can we resurrect that system again? How can we become a scientific country? And I think it's...
I'm very glad that you're emphasizing that, because that was very important.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Him.
Yeah, well I emphasize, he also refers to... Yeah. It was, how did you... Wasn't that strange that he went to, basically straight away, he went to Freiburg?
Yeah.
And there he pretty much, he went back and forth.
Yes.
But he pretty much, his scientific endeavor, he continued in Freiburg. How was that, how did people respond to that here?
Of course, I can't really say in general, but of course, there was this post-war period of denazification and what was it. There were strong feelings by some people. I didn't show them at all, but I'm not sure that they were strong enough. But I don't think so.
All right. Yeah.
No. I think it was quite a lot of sympathy. Of course, the only overt sympathy, if you like, came from organizations like Quakers and the certain organizations of that sort. But I don't know. It's difficult to say, isn't it? Because I mean, personally, I wasn't imbued with very strong feelings about it. Although I had fought in the war, of course.
You've
been wounded and so forth.
But
of course, in North Africa, we most greatly admire Rommel. Erwin Rommel was the hero of.
You
will have to. I mean, don't get to go into that.
Yeah, no, but there's this, there must be like this gentleman's agreement that Rommel was a fantastic general, of course, as a general.
Yeah.
But he still fought on the wrong side. And
But I mean, he didn't make a great fight. At least I certainly didn't. I wasn't at all conscious of it.
Yeah. And how was you met? So Brinkheim goes back to Oxford a lot.
Well, half a year really. He had to earn money.
Yeah.
You see, because I don't suppose that there was much available in Freiburg.
No. As I understand the documents, as well as you described them, he was still getting grants from the society, at least from the colleges.
He's doing some teaching.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But is there, one of the weirdest aspects of Springsteen, his Jewish background combined with that German patriotism.
Yes.
However, after the war, he goes on to Freiburg, in which where he does fantastic work. He's still honored there immensely, and rightly so, I would say.
Yeah.
But there's this, he has this Jewish background, and
yes.
At one point he must have gotten what had happened in Germany while he was in Oxford. And did he ever
think about that? I don't know, but I don't, because of course he didn't discuss the details, but I think he may have had some ambiguity about his Jewish belonging between the Sephardi and the Ashkenazi, I mean, which is a very important division in Judaism.
Yeah.
And he would have been Western over this.
Yeah.
And perhaps more skeptical about the Eastern Jews.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people in Germany were.
But that is before he goes. Before he goes to Oxford, he is put in a concentration camp for Jews.
Yes.
And there's some theories about how that. But the thing is, before he is targeted specifically, he basically I would say his mind state, as well as your description of it, is even though I am Jewish, I am so well respected that there are Nazi sympathizing students attending his classes and not disturbing them, for example, wearing the insignia. And is there an idea of him being sort of impervious or not targeted or?
I think he knew perfectly well that he was vulnerable, because otherwise that was why he sent his children away in 45.
Yeah.
45, I think, was important.
Mm.
45, the Nuremberg laws were important as showing even the most patriotic Jews they were not wanting them from the Nazi anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
They were liable to be dismissed. They were dismissed, in fact, they're not allowed to teach him.
Yeah. Schultz is heartbreaking. He's removed from Berlin. He's put in Frankfurt and basically focused on.
That's right. Yeah. So that was, in thinking about Nazism, you can't neglect the importance of the Hitler belief. I can make no exceptions.
Yeah.
Which is what he said to Max Planck. Yes, I think he said to Max Planck, I can make no exceptions.
To Max Planck.
Because, of course, Max Planck, Max Planck said that from possible science and so forth, this is they're doing enormous harm to Germany.
Yeah.
And Hitler apparently said, no, I can.
Yeah.
So, was very important.
Yeah, but that must have stung Springsteen. That must have really stung him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, I think it did.
Yeah.
And I think it's shown by the fact that he arranged for his family to everybody. This is the proof of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although he himself stayed on, wanted to do what he could, I suppose, to improve him, but nevertheless realized that he couldn't bring his family out in Germany.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what could the future have been? They wouldn't have been allowed to teach,
or worse. Yeah. But that makes his relation to Wiacker quite interesting. You know, Wiacker's background.
Yes.
As well as most Romans.
Yes.
Because Springsteen kept, even defended Wiacker after the war from attacks. Wiacker had his own Springsteen to a degree in his work, saying, well, Springsteen would. And Springsteen after war even defended Wiacker for that, saying, well, it was the circumstances.
Yes, well, of course, I don't know because you didn't talk about the echo, but I suppose he would have defended him from a scholar, as a serious scholar. Yeah.
Yeah. There's exactly, there is this disconnection between their scholarly work and their political pressures. They're scholarly, they remain scientists.
Yes.
Which I find very fascinating.
Yes, I think that's true. Yes.
No. Wasn't that strange for you when you met Jocker in Göttingen, knowing his... Did you know his background at that time?
Yeah, well, yes, I knew that he'd been very pronounced. I've written things. Criticizing Jewish scholars and so on. He'd gone strongly along those lines. I wonder something I think may be attributed to sheer fear of violence. I remember Dauber talking to me about this. Dauber's not one of the only people, but nevertheless, that the behavior of the jurists in Germany was really rather disgraceful because they're terrible and so forth. But when I talked to Dauber about this, he said, "Yes, but you've got to think about the threat to violence."
Yeah,
and I think that for quite a lot of people that was important.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the aspects that you have to think of, and he of course came very soon after, I don't know, 33 years. When he was advised by
Dauber. Did you have contact with Dauber?
Yes, he was my predecessor in the chair here.
Oh yes, already in that period, in right after the Second World War, or during the
Second World War. After the Second World War.
Yeah.
He was in Cambridge and then in. But he was my immediate predecessor.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I owe him the chair because.
Oh really?
You know, in those days, it was done behind the scenes. Who do you think would be?
Yeah, Dauber is in that we would have. We would have picked Dauber as one of the people to study because he is a Jewish scholar who fled quite early on.
Yes.
But the problem for us with Dauber was that he went to the United States in the Second World War, which means Dauber, contrary to what I would say, contrary to Prince Simon Schmidt, said he sort of loses contact with the continental scholarship.
I suppose he does,
He is still seen as a common law scholar today. Weirdly, his Roman law work is above all question. But it's not. It doesn't have sort of the centrality to the debate that Schultz and Prinzheim have.
That's perfectly true. And he wasn't. Yes, no, he was English or British in that sense. Whereas Prinzheim was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Schultz in his own way.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you, I don't know if you did. In Helsinki we've had Wolfgang Ernst for a congress who's written also in Juris Recruited, a biography of Schultz.
Yes.
And there is this at one point there's the chair at Edinburgh.
Yes.
Yeah, so you have a kind of fascinating story which I'm trying to get to the bottom of, but
yeah.
It's quite hard, but there's this vacancy for a chair of civil law in Edinburgh, and it's Daube, Pringsheim and Schultz that apply,
yeah.
And none of the three gets it.
I'm not getting it.
It's
very much in a local legal community looking after itself.
Yes.
Yeah. Very much so. No, it's not scholarly. No.
No, but it's there's a not. This is like the it's like having. We have three of the best Romanists in the world at
well,
the time.
you've got them all down.
Nobody remembers actually the name of the person who got this. It's a local lawyer.
It wasn't somebody who remember.
No.
But, I mean, if you want a parallel to this, after the war, 1947, I suppose, 48, perhaps it was, I applied for a lectureship in Hull, there were three candidates, I was turned down, and so was, you remember his name, he went to Australia, and did very well in Australia. The other candidate, his name will come back to me in a moment, and the third person was local, and was a work, and was appointed, and when we walked back to the station, this other colleague said to me, we were both much better qualified than this man, despite Taylor, he was appointed. Well, we were, but, and we became known, and all the rest of this, and he's never been heard of. But
yeah.
it was localism, you see.
Yeah.
And localism, quite important at that stage.
Yeah.
Localism also
connected
with the sort of feeling is continentalist of problem. Just
what would they teach you?
No, I mean, why?
Yeah.
Why would you want to?
Yeah.
To get that sort of person.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, that's very untold and so forth, and it didn't apply here. Yeah. But nevertheless, it's an element.
But how did Pringsheim inform your scholarship? Because you give just by reading, knowing Pringsheim's work, reading, knowing your work, they coincide at major point, but there are also some very important differences, mainly Greek philosophy, of course, is there, which you speak about, and the gradual development regarding that, the Eastern influence. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. I suppose it is a strong feeling for Roman law and I remember Dalva saying to me when I wrote this essay, which has become very well known on ownership, it could only have been written by a Romanist. So I can see it. I mean, it's not that I was conscious of it so much as that other people could see it.
Yeah.
This is the way you are thinking about the relations between civil law and common law, and how you fit them into coherent whole.
Yeah, but for that was also a feature of both Pringsheim and Schultz's school, that they, with Pringsheim, was obviously Greek law in a, to a high degree, but also a common law, that there are sort of general
elements which you can put together.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah. But Greek philosophy did not make that cut for some reason in Pringsheim. Certainly not in Schultz. Schultz is
This is mischief. Yeah.
Enormous mischief. As is the occur.
Yes. Yes. No, and I'm not that weak in my later age. Of course, I'm rather strongly influenced by Stoicism. But going back to that, no, I wasn't.
No.
It wasn't a major.
No. No, but exactly. You do turn already in Gaius. Yeah. There is a lot of reference to Aristotle.
Yeah. You know,
there's and that did Pringsheim. I can imagine that Pringsheim was less happy with those.
Yes. No, he wasn't. He wasn't happy, and he felt and when he was retired and was asked to make some general comments, he said, "I'm not sure that I have any very general comments to make."
Yeah.
He concentrated on particular cases, subjects, texts, and all of this.
Yeah.
I suppose he was textualist, yes.
Yeah. And
I guess I am rather too.
Oh, yes.
Yes, very much textualist, because I've been in this book.
Yeah.
Roman texts.
Yeah. But that makes two. There is another biography of Pringsheim,
yes,
written by Elmar Bundt, who is also a scholar of Pringsheim.
Yeah.
Like yourself, Bundt he basically makes the same remark with regard to Greek philosophy, saying, well, yes, Pringsheim was principally,
yes,
against the influence of Greek philosophy on Roman.
Yeah.
If there was a Greek influence, a Greek philosophical, it was a later influence, a post-classical.
Yeah.
And as the problem with that is usually that it's the same weird. So that I never, if you look at the text,
yeah,
it is the only point at which you can really say, Pringsheim is not being textual here; he's being principal.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
He's
being principal, not textual. That there are too many things in the text. Then you have to go with what Schultz does and say they're interpolated.
Yes. Well, which of course Pringsheim was also keen on at a certain stage. But I mean, like so many other people, he became a bit disillusioned in interpolation.
Yeah.
And I was never very caught up in the interpretation.
Oh, no.
I was skeptical about it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, from my very first book, the book on Gaius, is taking the what they say, the vocabulary, seriously as an indication of their thought.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was never my approach. That wasn't an aspect that I had drawn to any great extent.
Yeah, but by the time you were publishing, by the time Gaius interpolationary criticism was done, that Caesar made sure of that. And did Pringsheim, as a tutor, did he do interpolations?
A mix, yes.
Yeah,
yes. Yes, you would say, no, that can't be the original text. I mean, even with Gaius, yes, you can say that can't be.
You
are a bit inclined to do that. I don't think I was there very much.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I've always found
I'm not quite sure why, but some reason, must be some reason. Perhaps it's religious.
Mm.
Perhaps it's being brought up as an Anglican and taking seriously King James Bible or Book of Common Prayer.
I'm going to quote you on that.
Yes, that's it. Yes. We can just discard or rearrange these texts in the way that it is now convenient, I think.
Yeah. With Gaius, there was I don't know if you noticed, Schultz was so the common law version of the Institute is written by David White, right?
Yeah.
But it was originally Schultz who was approached to do a the addition of Caius's Institute.
Yes.
Which would have been phenomenal, obviously, because he's a fantastic Roman.
Yes.
But he also subscribes to a degree to the Glossa Agaio movement, that, that there have been emendations in the Caius text.
Yeah.
Did you know? Is there?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. No. It's one of the. Can you imagine a Caius edition made by Schulz?
Well, it would have been. No, it would have been. It wouldn't have been an acceptable edition. Well, it would have been interesting. Right?
It would have been interesting. Yes. Ernst has the Schulz's life's work was basically going to be an edition of Papinian's Christianis, because that is the holy grail for all the German scholars.
Yes.
So Schulz had, and Ernst actually has the edition, the manuscript of the edition.
Oh, the edition.
Yeah, so that might be published in the coming years. So Schulz's edition of
Schulz.
Yeah, I'm going to see it, and I simply can't wait. But Pringsheim was already so you have Pringsheim has the theory of the he disowns interpolationary criticism.
Yes.
Yeah. But there is still these the scholarly emendations made in later works.
Yes.
Yeah. What did you think of that? Because in Caius you...
Well, I was never tremendously taken with the echo on this. Yes, of course, there are some differences from copying and all this, but the trouble about this is that Justinian was so keen on the authenticity of the old texts, and so insistent on them, although they were not Christian, and he knew perfectly well they were not Christian. Nevertheless, the requirement that the authors and the box and so forth should be cited was central to the digest.
Yeah.
And that didn't seem to be compatible with the idea that they'd been changed a lot.
Yeah.
And the scholars would know that they had been changed, which, you know, like, wouldn't they?
Yeah. But that is that's always been with Pringsheim, and even to a stronger degree with Wiacker.
Yeah.
I always find that so incredibly weird, is that they make choices about how they view the text.
Yeah.
And of course they support it with theories about emendations, etc. But the choices themselves I find most interesting.
Yes.
And there's to me, Wiacker calling say rhetorical phrases, philosophical phrases in text, calling them academic, right?
Yes.
Not having any bearing on the actual law, which is there's this choice first and the explanation and later, and then comes the argument.
No, you're right. It's a sort of it's very instinctive in the end, isn't it? It must be very instinctive. Well, why do you choose to think this could not be classical?
The dichotomy between classical and post-classical, which you've also written on, which is usually right now it's not by far not as strong, not as strongly stated as it was by, for instance, by Pringsheim. There's this classical is phenomenal, and then there's this schism somewhere around 250, somewhat later, and And then after everything is bad.
Yes, I know, I agree. It's a strange way of looking at, at historical development, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is. There's an ideal which is classical, and then other things are inundations or something like that.
Yeah. Would you speculate about where that ideal comes from?
Or where the view comes from?
Yeah, we cannot.
Well, it has something, some connection with the given view about the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. Isn't it? There was an ideal period.
Yeah.
And then there's a fall, and it takes various forms and so forth, but it does, it operates in law as well as it does in literature and
government
and all the rest of it. And I've never been very convinced about that. In fact, I'm the one who can think against it.
Did you express that to Prinsheim?
No.
Was there a discussion?
No. I don't think so. I was too junior and sort of deferential. Too deferential in those early days. I may have harbored some doubt in the back of my mind.
If I read Gaius correctly, there are some relations with things Springtime says, which there's no direct reference to Springtime, but there is some, history has proven you right often on these points.
I've been lucky.
And then let me ask the. Have you followed the South African elections?
Yes,
by any chance. What did you think?
I think that. Let's start with a general view in South Africa. In South Africa, it's always in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
It's a permanent crisis, South Africa. And we've lived through some aspects of it. The Boer War, going back to one's earliest connection to the Boer War, immediately followed by a rebellion against Bosman Smuts because of the part of their having gone in with the English.
And so
you have a rebellion. And then that's put down, but nevertheless, behind the scenes, the resentment and so forth, and the feeling of Afrikaanderdom remains, and ultimately they acquire political power.
Yeah.
And then this becomes too absolute. The coming of Malala, the apartheid and so forth, and creates the resentment against you, which in the end builds up and leads to the, well, it's really interesting because Afrikaanderdom is very interesting because it did the difficulty adjust itself to being conquered by the British in the Boer War, and it's also adjusted itself to being overcome by the African National Congress.
Yeah.
Admittedly, through a negotiated agreement, but still, this adaptability of Afrikaanderdom is a very important factor in South Africa.
Yeah.
South African life. Now, what's happening now is very, very difficult to say how solid the constitution is, and we don't know, of course, that is it.
Yeah.
But it is the constitution which is the core of constitutional constitutionalism seems to me enormously important, and if I just think more generally about the ancient world as well as the modern world, must never neglect the importance of constitutionalism.
Even though you are a scholar of common law in England, which does not reason from a constitution in England, and Roman law, which does not have a written constitution.
Yes, but if we look at the reality rather than what is said, the two important rebellions, 17th century rebellions in England, were rebellions against an unconstitutional government.
Yeah.
A government which was exercising powers which it did not possess. That was how it was put. And it was unconstitutional. I mean, people talk about it as being religious, but although that's a sort of background factor, what was expressed was that the King Charles and then King James II were acting unconstitutionally. Yeah. Yeah. And constitution required them to respect certain things, to respect property rights and so forth, and also not to tax without the consent of Parliament.
Yeah.
It comes out to that. That was the Constitution.
Yeah,
it is a Constitution.
It's very interesting that you mention rights in this respect.
Yeah.
You've written on human rights in Roman law.
Yes, yes, yes.
Pringsheim has also written on rights in Roman law,
yes.
If I'm correct. Did your influence on the creation of the South African Constitution and the drive to fight apartheid with rights?
Yeah.
Is that something you took from Pringsheim, or is that something that...
difficult to say, isn't it? I think the constitutional aspect was and is important, and as you know, this piece that I wrote in South Africa,
from the Constitution of the
copying the German First World Constitution rather than the American Constitution.
Yeah.
It was a feeling because it was connected with the extension of citizenship in South Africa, which I said is parallel to the extension of citizenship 211 AD.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to ask yourself, what are the legal implications of this?
Well, yes, but citizenship in this vision particularly is only important because it gives access to a judge.
Yeah.
And I would say having that a written guarantee that then at least come close to this notion of rights. And
yes, I mean, I think the most recent little bit that I've done on slavery. It's two things. It's being entirely subject to some other person or group of persons as to what you can do. And secondly, not having access to authority to counteract it. Those two things seem to me to go together. In the definition of slavery.
I haven't seen that actually. I've actually done something on slavery. I did not know that. I'm sorry.
No reason why you should, but it's an introductory. And obviously the book is about slavery and modern law under the United Nations and all the rest of it. But they asked me to do a sort of introduction to interested. So this was the theme of the introduction.
Yeah.
So I mean, yes, of course it involves rights, but because in order to have access, you must have rights.
Yeah. Well, yes. Or in order to have rights, you will have access. So it is a sort of a strange coincidence that both you and Springsheim move towards the notion of rights in, let's say, unwritten constitutions.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but there's
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. You're absolutely right. Unwritten constitution. There are way to organize societies in which there's no constitution. The law is the constitution, but of course it may be behind the scenes.
Mm.
It is behind the scenes.
Yeah. Interesting. This is an aside, but we had Tom Bennett in Helsinki, the Cape Town, and he spoke on Ubuntu. He actually spoke quite phenomenally about it on Ubuntu.
Yeah.
So the Afrikaner conception, or the customary rule conception, you would know far more about that. Did you make the, I don't know if I took that from you, but it might very well have been the sort of the weird similarities between the notion of Ubuntu and Eukaryosis.
No, I haven't drawn that. I mean,
then I'm mistaken. No, I haven't
drawn that.
I haven't
about Ubuntu.
Yeah. Have you written about Ubuntu in general? Is that something you were interested in?
No, I haven't done that.
No, that's why it came. It came into my mind, but then it was. I took it from somewhere else, and I was planning on asking you anyway. So the only thing I really do want to the relation with Springsheim's pupils after the war. So you had I don't remember, Diaker must have been a little bit weird, knowing his background, but...
Yes, I met him, he was perfectly polite and so forth, but...
Yeah. You fought in the Second World War, and you fought against someone you respected, right?
Yes.
But still, and after, in that period, the true horrors of what had happened must have been widely known, so...
It's interesting, of course, because I was very severely wounded, and indeed thought to be dead in the Battle of Alamein.
Yeah.
I thought to be dead because my regimental doctor thought I was dead. And so
really?
When I turned up in South Africa 5 months later, he thought he'd seen a ghost.
did you correct him, or did you just?
No, I just told him. He didn't tell me himself, but I was told.
Yeah.
So I was not able to go back and fight after that. So I was at a thing called military college, which was in South Africa for the rest of the war before coming up to Oxford. Over the war, because I had this scholarship in 1940 when I was already in the army, and so but of course you couldn't take it up during the war. So I knew that if I survived the war, I would come up to Oxford, and that's what happened in the United States.
But Springsheim was a soldier in the First World War. Viacker fought, I think, I don't know. Did he ever fight during?
I'm not sure about the Viacker.
No, but for example, Koenig did fight in the Wehrmacht.
Yes.
And whether or not Viacker fought, I think in all three, there is this sort of militaristic virtue present.
Yes.
They have this. Yes. You describe it perfectly in Springsheim's work, right? But I think that also goes for people like Koenig and Viacker.
Yes.
And is that would you say you, there is, did that make you more connected to at least Springtime and Viaco? So it's the
maybe. No, I think some of us do understand
that. Yeah.
They undoubtedly do.
Yeah. So there was this, you were all veterans. Yes. That was.
No, yeah. I think you understand.
Yeah.
The motives and conduct of people who fight for their country. That seems to be important.
Yeah. Yeah.
All this has gone now, but it was important in its own day.
Yeah. Yeah, I find it to be amazing that people from so vastly different sides of a conflict can form this community in which it is not so much the content of the conflict that is important, but the fact that you all were in that conflict.
Yeah.
Is that a nice one?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's interesting, but it is a reality, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And you've met Viaker, did you meet any other pupils of Ringsheim after the war?
No, but tell you who was in the war at Freiburg, the Max Institute of Heidelberg. Hans Heinrich Jeschik was it. Because you see, when I went to work on causation in Freiburg, I worked at this Max Planck Institute.
Mm-hmm.
He was in charge of it, and he had been a tank officer, and he fought, well, I think mainly on the Eastern Front, against Russians, and I remember that he greatly respected the Russian tank people who he fought against and so on. But yes, no, I remember talking to him about the war. And it is the same thing, that you appreciate the fact that you're in a certain conflict. And,
yeah, yeah.
And certain things have to be done, but they're wrong.
Yeah, yes, yes. Amazing, yeah. Which institute, the Max Planck Institute of Legal, was that the Max Planck of Legal Philosophy? Or what was
the Max Planck Institute of Internationales und Sprache. It's called Comparative and International Criminal Law, something like that. So it's in Freiburg.
Okay, I didn't know. Yes.
I don't know. It's criminal law. It's
criminal law. Yeah. You've never actually been to Frankfurt?
Sorry?
You've been to Frankfurt as well.
But only just to give a lecture and so forth. But Freiburg was my German university.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. So Munich is very much my German university.
Yeah.
Which is weird because, I've been to Frankfurt, I've been to Berlin, but so that university remains your university for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. But have you met Cohen?
Yes. Because he came as a visiting fellow to All Souls. And he came with his wife. And that is an interesting story, of course, they were both married, but they had met in 38 or 39 in Paris before the Mona Lisa.
Really?
And they, of course, they knew the war was imminent, was coming on. And they said, I think this is true, let's meet again here in 20 years. And in 20 years' time, their partners had died, and they met again and got married.
That is...
I mean, I don't know. I mean,
one
it's
document.
Only what he said, but I mean, Cohen was rather a reliable person, actually.
Yeah. So you would not expect a German professor of legal history to be such a romantic.
Well, I mean, it was a very romantic story, of course.
It is, yeah.
But in a way, I can see it. Yeah. I mean, you know them moving into this unpredictable time.
Yeah.
Who knows if you survive?
Yeah. As I've read Cohen's autobiography, which has recently been published also.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
No. I mean,
there's an interesting episode where he went to South Africa. He did a lot of travels, and he also went to South Africa. And
yeah.
He had some rather dubious remarks on the relations between the black and white population there, which I always find funny because it is, for me, Cohen is sort of he is the man after the war to really get into natural law. And to really to go into the ethical underpinnings for laws such as human equality, much more so than Schultz or Pringsheim or any of them. So these remarks always sit sort of weirdly.
No, I can see that. I suppose because he was very European, wasn't he? The Cohen years.
Yeah.
And Europe was very central to Cohen.
Yes. European excuses. European, not legal history or German legal history.
You're right.
And the Pringsheim, that's also, I don't know, because in the Freiburg report, we can connect going to the European idea quite easily because he did work for Europe, for the European community.
Yeah.
Kosher, obviously, because Europa and the Römische Recht. Wiecker wrote fantastically, even in his later life, wrote fantastically about European law, European common core.
Yeah.
Schultz, I cannot connect to Europe, at least not explicitly. Yeah. But Pringsheim, I never thought I could connect him to Europe until I saw the Freiburg report, in which he actually refers to the need for a European organization, mostly to balance Germany and France, which I found fascinating. He must have been one of the first to even think about.
Yeah.
Did he speak about that?
No, but it was very much in his outlook.
Yeah.
I speak about this because my grandfather was keen on European unity in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
Was nothing happened. It was all swept away. But it did exist as a movement, you see, in the 20s and 30s, this European idea, particularly, obviously, about France and Germany. Well, yes, France and
Germany. Yeah. Yeah, but Pringsheim is quite explicit about how this European organization should take shape, really, I think.
Yes.
Like a union between states.
Yes.
And one of the interesting things about the role of education in general is incredibly important in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He took a part of the common law college ideas to back to Europe.
Back to Europe.
Yeah. Did he take a part of the German university culture back to Oxford?
If he did, I don't think it was very successful. No, certainly not if you are thinking of the dominant position of professors in Germany at a certain stage. That has never been part of the Oxford culture.
Yeah.
No, this is Oxford culture is a very utilitarian culture.
Yeah.
A very egalitarian
culture. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's not about...
No, it's not. I mean, professors are no better than anybody else.
Yeah.
College tutors are just as good in their own way and so forth. But, I mean, this particular university derives from a very egalitarian way of thinking about teachers.
Yeah. But that's not... Yeah, but Pringsheim.
That's not due to Pringsheim.
No, exactly. Pringsheim would have taken the status of the professor from Germany.
But I don't think he. I don't remember him talking along those lines at all.
Yeah. It does reflect from some of these documents that you have.
Yes.
That he not him, but particularly also his wife, that they have this air about them. And
yes.
I can imagine that.
Yes, no, he was very distinguished.
Yeah.
Yes, no, he wasn't a distinguished German gentleman.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know
that. He was a knight. Yeah, he must have been. Yeah. It must have been fantastic to have been.
Yes, no, it was wonderful. It was a great experience.
Yeah.
From my point of view.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. The legal reforms of Hadrian. You quote that. When did he write that? Do you know?
I don't know.
That's in the 60s, I think.
You think in the 60s?
Early 60s, yeah. Do you quote that in Gaius, or is that...
No, I don't think I do. I don't quote it
in Gaius. No, I was just wondering that. Yeah.
Because Gaius came out in 62 or something.
Yeah.
It's quite rather quickly. I wrote it rather quickly.
Yes. Yeah. From in 16 years from student to writing Gaius.
Right.
Right. Professor Hunter, I have everything I need.
I hope you have. I hope you've got some.
Yeah, I found it.
Something out of it, yeah. Particularly, of course, as regards play time, because I have a very interesting and affectionate relationship with him. And as you say, it may have something to do with us both having been in war or having been. Yes.
Yeah, I find that fascinating. It's something that it has indeed sort of gone, that this whole, all these professors who have been in wars and share these bonds, and this is the scientific
certain feeling.
Yes, it is something that my modern eyes. And also the relation with in Viacker in Roman virtues.
Yeah.
Where Viacker is very active in emphasizing specific Roman virtues as Roman.
As Roman.
And there must be some sort of mirror to himself, like the Roman virtue of bravery and fortitudo and things like that.
Yes. I think that's what.
Yeah.
You look past and you see yourself in the past.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. I'm in the process of writing a proposal for Oxford University Press for an English language version of my book on lesser book on human rights.
So I would
like to keep you posted on what happens.
By all means, yes.
Yeah. It's going. If it's published, it will be published in the History of International Law series.
History of International Law.
Yeah. Edited by Benjamin Stelman, who's in New York currently. I'm keeping my fingers crossed for that.
Very nice. Well, I hope it goes on anyhow. Immediately, are you going back to Finland?
No, I'm staying here for 2 more days.
Yes.
Mostly because I do love the Bodleian Library.
Yes.
And it's such an amazing place. I was in February. I was in the Redshift, designed for the SPSL archives.
Yes.
And the Oxford University Press Archives. But I also afforded myself a bit of time to see the Roman law section of the Bodleian, where your works are quite prominently displayed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you still do research? Do you still work?
Not really. I still do a bit of teaching, but That is really a big plus.
You're doing the seminars with
the Peter Tichy, with John Gardner.
But otherwise, I don't think I'm right.
Yeah. I understand, and I'm very sad to hear that.
Well, it was very well. You have to be satisfied with what you've written in order to be happy about.
Antonio Guarino just turned 100. He's still writing. Antonio Guarino.
Yeah. Yes, no, it's perfectly possible. But I just don't feel that up to it.
Will you publish your memoirs at one point?
No, I mean, I've done it privately for my family.
No, I'm
not going to write horrible things to be published over there.
Yeah.
I don't think it's very good.
I would very much disagree with that.
You would disagree with it. Well,
you kind of Yeah.
Well, we'll see.
And if you publish it, I will be the first one to buy it. But you have. It goes without saying you have a standing invitation to come to any place in the world to speak on the project and say anything you wish about it.
I'm all right, but I'm slow now.
You seem very fast to me, sir.